Welcome to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology, brought to you by the Media Economies and Design Lab at CU Boulder. I'm your host, Stephanie Abdalla, and joining me all the way from Brazil is Ana Miller, who is a biomedical specialist in neuroscience and behavior. She's also a fertility perception and hormonal health instructor, a menstrual educator, speaker, and content producer. Our conversation today will focus on the challenges and possibilities of discussing the menstrual cycle of women and people with a uterus online. How does social media enable and hinder this debate? We will talk about fertility tracking apps, data control, and safer alternatives for people with uteruses to understand their cyclicality. Finally, we will reflect on the history of this topic in the media, as well as in the academic discourse. Ana, thank you so much for joining us today. I'd love if you could explain a little bit about your work and what made you interested in following this path.
Hello, Stephanie. Hello, everyone. So this is Ana speaking. And first, as you mentioned, I studied biomedical sciences. However, the beginning of my story with neuroscience of the menstrual cycle and hormonal neuroscience is not at college, unfortunately. So I studied 4 years of college in Brazil. I actually spent 1 year of college in the US, yes, in New Jersey. And then when I came back to Brazil, I started studying neuroscience. So here in Brazil, we have a kind of postgrad studies, but it's not really master's. So I'm not sure if you guys understand it, but it's something in which you specialize on. And I decided to specialize on neuroscience because I was working with learning methodologies at that time. And then during that time of the neuroscience course, I went to a women's event. And at that event, like nothing related to science. And then this woman, she was telling something about behavior changing depending on menstrual cycle phase. And then I was confused slash nervous slash like, what is going on? Because I have a bachelor's in biomedical science. I am almost at the end of this neuroscience course and no one has ever like considered mentioning that something is wrong. And then I hyper-focused on that. I decided to do my final project of the neuroscience course on that. And then I found out that it really is a thing. Yeah, we're going to talk about how this all of this happens and how old is it. But then I began to study more and more and more. And then I found out that outside of Brazil, we have this fertility awareness instruction courses. And I became a specialist and a instructor as well. So what I do today is I teach people with uteruses how to better understand how their menstrual cycles impact their lives into productivity matters, fertility matters, cognition, emotions. So in summary, this is what I do.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for this introduction. I'm already super excited to talk more to you about this. Now, Ana, the purpose of Looks Like New is to engage with old questions in new ways. So I'm curious to know, what is the history of discussions regarding menstrual cycles? Can we say this is an old debate?
It's very interesting because the first time we talked about me being part of the podcast, this is what I mentioned. I said, this title is perfect when we're talking about menstruation studies and all these hormonal health studies, because yes, this is a very, very old talk. There is this author, I can't remember her name now, but there is a quote. She says that periods are the most unsecret we're trying to keep. So, women from the Stone Age had periods. Cave women had periods, yes? And this is not a secret. And when we study scientific findings and historical findings from like thousands of years ago, we see that people from that time, they did have kind of understanding of how this menstrual cycle works. Of course, it's very different from what we have today, and we're going to discuss that in about scientific findings. But the paintings and sculptures and all these items that we have to study human history, they show that thousands of years ago, people used to compare women to the moon. Why? Because they understood that sometimes this woman is bleeding. Sometimes this woman is on a period where she's more active. And then they started to understand that this had a relation with fertility as well. Because they imagine you being a person thousands of years ago. Yeah, we didn't have Google, we didn't have books, but we had nature. And this is where science came from. And when we look into their these people trying to explain the menstrual cycle, they did understand that if a woman is pregnant, there is no period. So probably periods have something to do with fertility. And we do have these ancient religions where there were goddesses. And then the women's body tended to be related to fertility and nature and amazing things, which is very different from what we see today. But yes, historically speaking, we do have findings that show that this is not new for us. They did know that something happened. Of course, not as technically speaking as we do know today.
This is fascinating. I am so intrigued already. But for as much as this history is intriguing and definitely worthwhile knowing, you're a scientist, as you mentioned, right? And your scope within this conversation is more focused on the academic discourse. So can you tell us what's being discussed in the scientific academic field about it? Are there challenges in studying this particular topic?
Well, I do love the historic part of it, but yes, of course, this is my, like, the one that I love the most to talk about. So there are many things we need to consider when we are talking about scientific findings regarding the female body. So, of course, we're talking about people with uteruses, but it's very hard to, like, separate things when we're talking about cultural and historical decisions worldwide regarding things that are related to the female body and the female history and the female people around the world, right? So, of course, today we understand that not only people who consider themselves female have menstrual cycles, but here I'm gonna mostly bind these things together because historically it is important to understand that we still live in a binary world. So there are many things we need to understand. The first I would like to mention is when we go to PubMed, which is like this scientific place where we have many articles and papers, and we look into like neuroscience of menstrual cycle, we have a beginning of scientific production happening around 2005, so like 20 years ago. And we have a higher volume like 10 years ago, so 2014-ish. Many things are happening at this exact moment to understand better the female body. And if we're thinking about the history of humanity, this is like 15 seconds ago, like 10 years. It's like 1 second ago, or not even that. There are some historic marks that we need to consider as well. In 1977, there was a decision from the FDA to exclude, this is very important for you guys to pay attention, so to exclude women of childbearing age from clinical trials. So from 1977 until 1993, when this was reviewed, no women were allowed to be part of phase one clinical trials.
Wow.
Yeah. There are many reasons for that. So the first explanation was that during the 70s, we had a big problem with a drug that was released and pregnant women had kids with malformation. So this was the justification. So we cannot have women on clinical trials. But other than that, the justification was like, it's too hard to control all variables on women's bodies. Why? Because the hormonal system is too variable. And then let's think about it. So many of the drugs we use nowadays were developed during these years from 77 to 93. So what science decided to do, and I'm like just putting science as this institution or something, but science is made of people. But what was decided is we are just going to assume that everything in the female body is just the same as the male body, except for having uterus and ovary. But this only matters for reproduction. And we just decided to assume that. But nowadays, and then there's a very, very nice book on that. It's called Invisible Women, The Data Bias on a World Designed for Men. I can send you, and then we can have this on the description of this episode, because she has several scientific papers explaining that we missed very important things. So we are assuming that a drug that was developed only considering the male body is going to work in our bodies exactly the same. We didn't study bioavailability, we didn't study efficacy, we didn't study the threats on the female body specifically for several years. And then today we have an enormous gender gap in science because we never really studied what happens if you have a complete different hormonal system. Because nowadays we know if I have a uterus, if I have ovaries, everything is different in my hormonal system. So maybe the bioavailability of drugs will be different as well. And then we have this kind of bizarre things going on, like, for example, Alzheimer's disease. 2 out of 3 people with Alzheimer's are women. However, all the animal model studies, they are just with male rats because female rats have an estrous cycle, which is the same thing as the menstrual cycle. So, I mean, I know I've opened many windows here, but it's just for us to understand that, like, 10 years ago, we started to understand that hormonal systems, they are different, and we need to get a better comprehension on that. And nowadays, even sports competitions, like, for example, the Manchester female soccer team, they design their trainings depending on the menstrual cycle phase of the athletes. So many nice things are happening. But we do need to understand that this is very recent, like it's baby steps. So not sure if I have covered everything on the question, but yeah.
No, you definitely have. And like my head is exploding right now, you know, like because I'm going back to when I was a kid in school, right? Like learning science. And you're very right. Like all the models I remember seeing labs or even in textbooks were male models, right? I think I was already an adult when I saw for the first time women's chest muscles, right? Like the boob muscle. And I was mesmerized because how come I have that in my body and I've never seen a picture of it, right? Like in terms of those scientific models we see in textbooks. So this is definitely like fascinating, but scary at the same time. So are these gaps being addressed at all in current scientific debates?
Yeah. So recently, and then I would say like 5 years from now, we started to have this kind of projects to end gender data gap in science. Yes. So not only more women in science, yeah, but because at this day, nowadays, we have more women in science, but we don't have more women as directors of labs. So we do need to understand that we have more women studying science, but we still have more men as directors of labs. So what is going on? So we have this kind of gender gap, but now the big projects, like regarding partnership of big universities, they are trying to address other kinds of studies in which we are to start covering this data gap. So to start understanding how this hormonal system works, how we should be addressing what is different if we're talking about specific diseases. So, for example, I don't know if you know that, and it's important for you that is listening to this podcast, but when we're talking about stroke symptoms, so they are different in men and women. We are used to looking for pain in the chest and things like that, but in women, stroke symptoms can look a little bit more like a stomachache or a heartburn. And this is the reason why many women don't look for medical treatments, or they don't go to the doctor when they have this kind of symptoms, because they would never consider that this could be a problem in the heart. But it could. And we're not even talking about this, because in men, chest pain is much more common. So yes, there are big projects that are starting to understand that this is important. So I really believe that in the next like 10 or 15 or 20 years, we will have large developments. There are some institutions and foundations that are looking at this specific point. And I strongly believe that we can, as a planet and as humanity, address this issue.
Hopefully you're right. And that leads me to my next question, because for as much as we want to see these changes happening in the scientific academic field, we also got to understand that they take time. So how can we address these gaps and contribute to a broader conversation through other means, right? So you're a big advocate for making all this information public. And in fact, you actively contribute to doing so through social media. So in your opinion, how can online platforms facilitate and challenge the whole discussion about fertility perception, hormonal health, and cyclicality?
Well, I think it's really important. And I strongly believe that we are just talking about this as much as we are at this moment because of social media. However, when we're talking about scientific discoveries and sharing scientific knowledge, it's very hard because we are also in a battle like with misinformation. So it's a very complex universe, because everyone can just like, you could just create an account and start talking about menstrual cycle if you want. No one is going to check if you have a background on that. Is this information reliable? So although I really believe that social media has helped us enormously in understanding different topics, I strongly believe as well that we should always check background. So who is this person that is saying all these things? Does this person study this? Has this person ever been on any kind of formal education about this topic? So I really believe we could benefit from social media knowledge. And of course, I do that a lot. But as a content consumer, I always tell people, like, pay attention, because my DM on Instagram is full of people asking things that they saw on a random page, and they are like scared now, because as I also work with fertility, people are very scared of getting pregnant because we know nothing about our bodies. And then they come to me and they ask like very bizarre things that they saw someone saying on TikTok, let's say. So yeah, it's complex.
What would you say are the main misconceptions circulating online about this topic?
Most of them, I would say, are related to fertility. Yeah, so it's very clear that our sexual education is failing, like really failing, because sometimes I get asked questions like, can I get pregnant if I just touch my partner? This kind of question comes to me. But related to like periods, I think the most important one of them is it impossible to get pregnant if you are on your period? And the answer is, it's not impossible. It depends. It depends on the average cycle you have. So how long is your cycle? Is it really a period? Because we are not taught to understand if the bleeding that I'm having is a period or not. So this would be the first misconception. The other one is people still believe that they have periods when they are on birth control. And this is not true. Because when we are on birth control, the cycle gets blocked. So the bleeding that we have under birth control is not menstruation, is not a period. It's just a bleeding that we have because we are not taking the pill for this, let's say, 7 days. So it's withdrawal bleeding. I think this is the two like top misconceptions. Ah, and one more, let's say three of them. Is it always a problem if I see any kind of liquid on my panties? Like, is it always problematic? Do I have to see the doctor? And the answer is no. Your vulva is just like your mouth. It's like liquid. So it's mucus. So it's designed to produce secretions. And that's okay. Most of the times it's okay. So I think these are the three top ones.
And still very basic things, right? That we would hope that through basic sexual health education, people would understand. And that points obviously to what you were saying earlier. There's also a gap in education through schools, right? And then you also mentioned like that people should definitely double check their sources, right? Definitely do not believe everything you see online. But like, what are other tips you would give for people to understand their bodies a little better, and especially to identify these misconceptions they are seeing online?
So I see we have two ways here. The first one is observe your body. So get connected to it. Like, we are living in a moment where the mind is definitely over the body and we're not even paying attention to the body. So when I see something online, I should always be cautious, like paying attention. Does it make sense to me? And then again, double check, triple check. Go and talk to the person if you have a question. Don't just Google something and believe the first answer that comes, like the summary. And also, if you can, if you find this useful, the best source for us is scientific papers or even at least books. Yes. So if you saw something, you are a little confused about it, just go to PubMed.com and try to see if there's anything on the scientific community about that. So if there isn't, probably there's something wrong. So, but I know it's something that most people don't do, but I would definitely suggest that.
Well, and also I think it's not only a matter of like lacking the interest, but a lot of the times it's really hard to understand these academic articles that are out there, especially scientific ones, if you're not from a science field, right? And that's where I think people like you who are doing this job of translating all this academic information, scientific information into a language that is more accessible to broader audiences is really important, right? So can you explain a little bit more in detail what exactly is the content that you produce?
Yeah, and that is also something important to mention in this, like, can I trust this or not? Does this person talk about the source of this information? This is a very important thing. So is this coming out of this person's mind, or is this person saying, oh, I studied this in this book or that book, and etc. So what I do is, my main field of study is neuroscience of the menstrual cycle. So I try the most to get updated. So every time something new comes out, I will read the paper and then try, as you mentioned, try to translate it in a very informal language, let's say. And then I would bring this knowledge. So every time I have something that is from a scientific paper, I would cite this paper and then tell, oh, this is from this article. And sometimes I also have these classes where I have a Zoom meeting with people and then I tell them. So what I do, the way that I produce content, is I will go to books, articles, and especially I try the most to be updated into the scientific productions. And then I would read the paper and translate, as you mentioned. So, but every time I'm mentioning a specific paper, I would cite it. And then I try to like make videos out of it. And then I make cards out of it. And sometimes I also offer these classes where I would not just talk about one specific paper, but I would start from the beginning. So let's talk about the menstrual cycle. And then, because as we just said in the last question, most questions that come to me at first, they're very basic. So I need to level everyone, and then I can talk about how hormones act on cognition, productivity, and stuff. So I like to have this like 2-hour classes where I can show people like from the beginning until the end, how can you cycle sync, for example, how can you organize your routine depending on the phase of the cycle. But I cannot just tell this to a person that doesn't even understand yet like anything about the menstrual cycle. So I do that through classes, as I mentioned. Sometimes I write texts, sometimes I do some videos, but I always try to tell people where did this information come from. I think this is very important when we're talking about content production.
Yeah, that's also an awesome and also a great tip, right? So if people are out there looking for things online about their bodies, make sure whoever you are seeking this information from is citing sources, right? That's definitely a green flag if there's a source being cited, which of course doesn't mean everything. You still have to go and double check it. In terms of like this dynamic that exists in social media, so like you have people sending you questions and you're also offering these classes, how do you feel like this community is being brought around this topic? Would you say there is a community? And if so, what's common? What's commonly being discussed within this community?
I've been working with social media content sharing for almost 5 years now. So I can definitely see a community like coming, and we are together. Of course, I'm inside a bubble. So this is my community. I've been talking about it, but I've seen that throughout these 5 years, many more women came. And there is one nice thing that is happening. Like 2 years ago, I started having lectures on companies. And nowadays, I've been to many big companies here in Brazil, and they come to me. I don't have to go for them. I don't have to seek for them. And then they hire me to come and have this lecture inside the workspace. So although we still have a very male-oriented kind of work, I can see that companies and leadership people, they are trying to make things more equal as well. So, and mainly what has been discussed is this work style, because this is the main thing we need to understand when we're talking about neuroscience of the menstrual cycle, or when you're talking about hormones. Women or people with uteruses are looking for a linear kind of routine that we will never achieve, because this is not how our body works. If you are a person that has a uterus and you live with a person that doesn't, you might feel like there's something wrong with you, because this person is so stable. And I can individually share that, because really my partner, he's very stable. And this is because the male hormonal system is on a day basis. So it's very similar to the sun. In the morning, people with testes will have a rise on testosterone, and these testosterone levels will get lower during the day. And it's the same thing with the sun. So during the morning, the sun rises, and then we have later on a sunset and everything. But, and then now we're remembering that thousands of years, someone also mentioned that we have a hormonal system that works during 24 to 36 days. So what for us would be noon is like the middle of a month. The moment in which my sun, yes, let's put it this way, is on top in my life, is actually not during 24 hours, but it's during the entire month, which means that I have 1 week or like 4 to 5 days that will be night in my body, which is the moment that I'm bleeding. And it's very smart to adjust my routine depending on that. And this has been discussed a lot in these corporate events that I have been going to, and this community in social media as well. Women are understanding that this is important.
Would you say, because we're still, even though you're mentioning these big companies and workspaces that are willing to kind of like embrace the cyclicality of people with uteruses, we are still kind of like going against a neoliberal capital system that wants productivity at its best all the time, right? What are the initiatives to address the needs, the particular needs of the cyclicality that you are seeing taking place, especially in Brazil, where you're from, but also like in a more international conversation?
I can see that at this moment, people are still just curious. So we're starting to understand that this happens, but we're not seeing like broad initiatives. Of course, there are countries that have approved like menstrual leave, which is something very important if you have endometriosis, for example, or something that actually makes difficult for you to work during your period. And on these companies that I go to, what they do is sometimes they offer the employees to work from home depending on their cycles. So this is one first baby step that I can already see that is something positive. But of course, we're talking about people that they have jobs that are okay to do from home. Yes, not definitely not for everyone. So as a system, as broader picture, to be honest, I am still not sure how we will really turn this workspace thing into a more equal environment. So we are at the very beginning of it. And in Brazil, especially like country-wise, nothing is going on. Like there are these specific companies that come to me and everything, but there is no law. Nothing is being discussed at this moment.
Well, so it definitely opens up the agenda, right? For us to request that more of our politicians, for us to make sure to include this debate in more spaces, that being the academic workspace, that being a corporative workspace. And definitely works like yours are important for contributing to all of this and especially potentializing all of these discussions and hopefully positive outcomes that will emerge with them. Going back to talking about media and now considering a broader media landscape, here I'm talking about journalistic outlets, media activist initiatives, the entertainment media, etc. Would you say they are engaging enough in this conversation? What are the gaps that you identify?
Oh, I wouldn't say media is engaging enough in this conversation. Actually, I can see that there is a marketing thing going on. Like we always talk about this industry that is trying more and more and more to sell to women. So I can see that some brands are recognizing this thing, like this movement for more natural periods and stuff, but still in a broad way, like, are we really discussing this the way we should? No. So there is no open channel TV show in Brazil that has ever addressed this. There are some specific TV shows from like streamings that I know that have mentioned this, but we're not even close to mentioning it the way I believe we should be.
Would you say this also applies to more alternative media initiatives, more activist, feminist alternatives? Would you say they're also lacking in their participation about this?
In this specific aspect, I don't think so. I think we are engaging more. But like concerning all the population, we're still behind. But I can see that, and it's very interesting because, as I mentioned, the last 10 years have, let's say, volume in how the female body works. So at this point, when we go to discussions on public policies and stuff like that, it's not just a matter of, oh, we want things to be better for us. No, we're showing it. We have scientific data that shows this. Our bodies are different and we should be addressing it. So I think that people that like feminists and advocacy is actually what is pushing this, like to make things happen.
But there's still a long way to go, right? Just like many of the other social issues that we got to tackle in society.
Absolutely, definitely, yeah.
On the note of discussing the online landscape, I feel like it's extremely relevant to consider the fertility tracking apps on which so many people with uteruses, especially women, rely. debates about data collection and protection raise concerns, obviously, about how safe these apps are for people. What's your take on this? Are there safer ways to do this tracking? And how can people find out which alternatives work for them best?
Yeah, we have to talk about this. Yes, we've had to start talking about this even more, about this privacy thing. So nowadays, I have only two apps that are cycle tracking apps that I know of their privacy concern and everything. One of them is called Embody, and the other one is Read Your Body. So Embody is more like for a person who is starting to track their cycle, and Read Your Body is more for fertility awareness. So you should have a minimum knowledge of your cycle to be using Read Your Body like well. But both of them, they only store your data on your cell phone. So there's no cloud data storing. On Read Your Body, there is, but only with an encrypted key. And you are the person who has your backup. And for Embody, it's like you cannot, there is no possibility of offering your data to them. And this app was built like with this as a top priority into development. So as for the other ones, I can't tell, but I know that there are some of the most famous ones that are like very linked to companies that nowadays are not very concerned with privacy. So I would definitely go deeper and understand, is the app that I'm using concerned, or how is this app using my data? And of course, we don't necessarily need to use apps for doing that. Yes, we can always go back to writing, which is something, it's not common for us anymore, but it's very important. It's very useful. So we are not, I mean, we don't have to use apps necessarily. But if we do, I would definitely check their privacy concern. And if you type on Google, like, oh, the name of the app and privacy concern, if it is an app that is privacy concerned, you will definitely find this information. If it's not, maybe you won't find anything because they won't just say, oh yeah, we do sell your data.
And how important is it, no, to be concerned about these private issues? And obviously this is a bigger conversation than the particular topic we're discussing here. But if we are to dive into specifics, why is it important for us to be concerned about our privacy and the privacy of our data when it comes to tracking our cycles?
Here in Brazil, especially, we have one concern that has been debated, which is abortion. So because we live in a country where abortion is prohibited. And then depending on the way you use these apps or what you add to these apps or not, you could, because, well, people still do it. Well, although it is prohibited, people still do it. So in a scenario where my data is not only mine and some kinds of things may be added to this, so what is going to happen with this person? So in the very specific scenario, we have been discussing this, me and my other menstrual educator friends. And other than that, if we are to have our data leaking, so they should know when to offer things for us. So for example, we know that we get more emotional when our periods are coming. So let's imagine that this information is being sold, and then maybe it is going to alter or to influence the kind of ads that I receive during that time. It might happen. So if we are understanding that these phases influence our behavior, And these people that are not even a bit concerned about using this in a good way, like if our behavior is being edited, I'm definitely telling, I'm literally telling the app how I'm feeling, what are my patterns, what are my emotions, and what can an advertisement company do with that? Many things, I believe. I think this would be my biggest concern.
Thank you for that clarification. And it's definitely something to be looking out for. You briefly mentioned more analog ways to do the tracking, right? Go back to writing. I don't know, come up with a charge. What are the ways that you recommend if people are trying to escape these apps a little bit and escape more broadly the online landscape for this tracking of their bodies?
You know that habit trackers that we do, like we have a kind of a table or a sheet, and then we add like and have a habit, and then you like you can paint it or just put an X on it if you did the habit or you didn't or whatever. You can do the same thing with your cycle. You can have a table for your complete cycle, and then what do you wish to track? Like, oh, am I happy? Am I sad? Or did I have cramps? Or didn't I? Or did I have a migraine? And then you can go and check. Then you have one complete table for day one from your cycle. Like, let's remember that the cycle starts on the first day of bleeding. And then until the last day of the cycle, so until you bleed again, you have this complete table where you have a view of how your emotions changed or your body changed. And this is very simple. You can print it out or you can just like literally draw a table on a piece of paper. Or you could do the same, but in like a rounded format, like a mandala, exactly. Like a mandala, exactly that. And then you have this pizza slices where they are the days of the cycle, and then you can draw symbols, you can paint, the same thing, but in a round shaped form. So this is easy. You don't have to buy like anything. You can just come and use a plate and do it yourself.
That's awesome. Thanks for the tip. Hopefully people at home are going to try some of those alternatively to apps. And if you're looking for apps, definitely follow Anna's suggestions as well to protect your data and your privacy. For my last question, Anna, I'm wondering, and considering the broadening of feminist discourses, but also the ascension of more radical conservative ideals worldwide, how do you see the conversations about menstrual education evolving? What are the challenges and opportunities we can predict?
Oh, Stephanie, this is a very complex issue. If we were to be recording this, like, let's say 2 months ago, I would maybe have one kind of opinion. And now that we are seeing these conservative speeches like getting broader and broader and broader, I am really not sure what can we expect. So I know for a fact and from data that like 10 years ago, things started to evolve. But although menstrual education and sex education, sometimes they come together. And when we have these conservative speeches, we tend to leave all these things, like neglect all of them. So I really don't know what is going to happen in the next few years. There is one side of me that believes that we can keep evolving in this conversation. And as I always say, I love to do what I do. I really love my job, but I don't want the next generations to understand about their cycles on their 30s, on their 40s. This is not what should be happening. we should have this kind of talk in schools. And then if we were to do that, we have to have a people like drawing laws and that are concerned with that. That want humanity to progress and not to regress. So unfortunately, we are on the hands of those who create the laws. And it depends on who is there. And this is the same for the US, this is for Brazil, this is for every country. We are always depending on the interests of people that are in charge of the country. So I can't really tell what is going to happen. At this exact moment, we have a government in Brazil that is developing a menstrual education system and project. And recently we had the regulation of distributing pads for people, for poor people and everything. But if, like, let's say 2 years from now, the government changes, will this project still go on? We don't know. So I really want to say that we will keep evolving, but unfortunately, like collectively speaking, I can't tell.
And I mean, I totally understand that. I think it's very hard not to feel somehow like hopeless sometimes, depending on who is in charge. And as you said, who is designing policy for all of us, right? On a more hopeful note, maybe, I wonder if there are other instances we can rely on. And here I'm mentioning not necessarily people who are designing policy, but maybe activist groups who are at least broadening the discourse or who are actively engaging in activities to spread more education about this topic, or even, as you mentioned, like supplies eventually, right? Could we look at these organizations to find some hope, maybe?
I think so. Yeah, here in Brazil, we have some organizations. I'm part of one of them as a volunteer, but that's it, right? We can look for them when we're talking about local issues and like initiatives, but on a broader way, not really. So yeah, I believe they are very important, but still it's impossible to like cover all the problem just with this small collectives. But still, they are the ones that go to, let's say, legislation and this moment, and they say, oh, we need to talk about this. Or even they sometimes can connect with private institutions. Here in Brazil, we have this a lot. So we have some NGOs, and they connect to some private institutions and companies. And these companies, they have a certain amount of money that they can offer to social work. And then throughout this money, you can kind of do something. And this is something that happens a lot here in Brazil. So these initiatives, they are very important, and they don't lead us, they don't let us so like passive in this thing. Yes.
Right. Well, thank you so much for pointing that out. And let's make sure collectively we are supporting these alternatives as well. Right. And well, thank you so much for your insights, Ana. I feel like we could be talking about this for hours, but unfortunately, our time is up. I look forward to continuing this conversation with you, but also with our audience through other platforms.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. This is a topic that I love talking about. And for you that is listening, please comment and then come to us, talk to us about it. Because the first time I heard it, I was like, I don't know. Is it true? Isn't it? And then when I started to understand it, I said, oh, okay, we have to talk about it. So I always have a challenge for people who listen to me talking about this is, now that you've heard of it, you need to tell this to three other people. It's like the movie, yes, the thing where you share something good. So share this when you are having lunch with your family or your friends. Oh, did you know that our behavior changes depending on the menstrual cycle phase? Did you know that people that have uteruses and people that don't have, they have different endocrine systems, and that impacts our cognition? It's a talk that might be interesting.
Definitely. Well, let's take up the challenge, you all. Thank you so much, Anna.
Thank you.
You have been listening to Looks Like New, a show that asks old questions about new technology. Looks Like New comes to you from the Media Economies Design Lab at the University of Colorado Boulder, and it is produced by Alexander Lipka. You can find us on the airwaves across Colorado's Front Range on KGNU Community Radio on the fourth Thursday of every month, and online at lookslikenew.net or wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you will join us next month.